The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
The complete monad, the one in which there is the maximum of clarity and perception and distinctness, clarity and distinctness. Well, at any rate, we see then how he is attempting to relate this then to meaning and to purpose. And we find then that, as I've suggested just the last moment or two, that his ideas are very much linked to that of freedom. The kingdom of grace, Leibniz took the nature grace scheme, an idea that was in the Middle Ages of nature, and then another realm of grace. He applied that, and Dooyeweerd maintains he secularized that notion and applied it in this way, that the kingdom of grace is freedom, and that this freedom then comes, of course, by clear and distinct thought. Nature, on the other hand, is a lack of freedom, and that is an area of unclear thought or unclear representations. And so we find in this way that there's an understanding of sin, that sin arises in the world by way of a lack of clarity and distinctness, that we do not have sufficient clarity and distinctness in our conceptions. And so if we then gain more clarity and distinctness again, we shall be overcoming sin. Now, as we noticed, that in this clarity there is an infinite gradation. The monads form a graded series, and this is according to a principle that there are no leaps in nature. That's a very important principle here, that there are no leaps in nature. If you have the monads, there's no space between them. There's no gap between them, the principle that there are no leaps in nature. So there's a gradation from the least clear representation, which we find in matter, to the completely clear representation in the central monad, God. We have the gradation then from the matter to God, from matter where there is the least clear representation to God where there is the most clear representation. Now, Hermann Dooyeweerd, and as I say, we are following in this part of the course pretty closely his discussions in the second part of the first volume of the New Critique. Hermann Dooyeweerd finds in Leibniz' doctrine of the monads as animated extensionless points of force an attempt to rescue the ideal of personality. I suggested that just a few moments ago. He attempts to rescue the ideal of personality from the threat of the new mechanical ideal of natural science. If we want the reference, that's in volume 1, pages 230 and 231. Now, the idea of monads is in accordance with the rationalistic, individualistic ideal of personality, which we found was characteristic of the Renaissance. So this idea of the monads accords with this rationalistic, individualistic ideal of personality of the Renaissance. Now, this is also the case that incarnated in Leibniz's view is also the Renaissance ideal of man. Now, notice that there was a Renaissance ideal of man, and I believe that we discussed that very briefly in relationship to a Christian ideal of man. But you have here a Renaissance ideal of man, that one is supposed to participate to the fullest in as many aspects of experience as possible. And a Renaissance man is supposed to be the man such as a Leonardo da Vinci, for example, who expresses in himself to the fullest extent possible all the possibilities. And here we find this so. We find in the microcosm, in man as the microcosm, the cosmos in cameo, you might say, in a small way, the reflection then of the macrocosmos, the cosmos in its broad extent. Now, the relation then of the substances to each other, he said further, is that of a pre-established harmony. There is here a pre-established harmony, a harmony in this order that is established then beforehand, or pre-established harmony. And this harmony is given to the monads by the central monad god. Here, if we have had a secularized view of in Leibniz's position, we have here then a secularized view of God's providence. That there is a pre-established harmony given to these by the central monad god. And there is an uninterrupted determination of the activity of all substances. There is a pre-established harmony in which these realize the purpose of the creative universal monad or spirit, which gives the impetus to the entire mechanical determination of their representations of the whole. I'll have to unpack that just a moment. But if we think then of God, that it is then the order, the harmony of the various modads are an expression then of his activity, his determination, that God then uninterruptedly determines the activity of all substances. There is a pre-established harmony in which all of these monads realize the purpose of the universal monad or spirit. And this universal monad or spirit is that which is the impetus of the entire mechanical determination of their representations of the whole. And so if each one then represents the cosmos from its own point of view, with its own degree of clarity and distinctness, then this then is, God is the impetus of this mechanical determination of their representations of the entire cosmos. So in the expression of the mechanical, in mechanical terms of the purposes of the universal spirit, Leibniz attempted to reconcile the mechanical and the teleological views of things. So you have your mechanical model going through. Nevertheless, you have this view of the monads, and in this view, there is the attempt to reconcile the mechanical and the purposeful. However, as Dooyeweerd points out on page 230 of this first volume, he maintains that the individual is a function of the mathematically conceived chain of monads. Is it the case then that this mechanical determination, even though it be said that it be by the central monad, does this then overwhelm the individual? Dooyeweerd says yes, that the individual here becomes a function of the mathematically conceived chain of monads that makes then the individual subject to rational calculation. It would mean that there is the independency from rational calculation, the self-determination of these monads would be thrown into question. Again, the idea of self-determination is threatened. And so there's a question. There's a real question, in spite of all his efforts, whether there is a real place for freedom, for human freedom in Leibniz's thought. Is the humanistic view of freedom as self-determination swallowed up in the mathematically conceived whole in which everything can be bridged in a universal calculus? Remember that he was very much involved with this idea of calculus. Is everything then able to be grasped in a universal calculus? And in this way, is not the idea, humanistic idea of freedom, again, undermined? Well, the next person we want to deal with is John Locke. I spelled his name before, L-O-C-K-E, John Locke. And his dates are 1632 to 1704, 1632 to 1704. Now, we've seen then how the enthusiasm for the new mathematical methods influenced the philosophy of René Descartes, how he sought to discover the foundation upon which human mathematical reason could construct the cosmos in an independent and creative way. Mathematical model, tearing things down, building them up again in a foundation which is mathematical in character. We saw how the mathematical ideal of science was transformed in the thought of Thomas Hobbes into an attempt to understand all of experience in terms of the idea of mechanical motion. And then we observed in the thought of G.W. Leibniz how the discovery of the infinitesimal calculus was understood as providing a means of bridging over the uttermost polarities in the world. This was going to give us, by this calculus, we were to get be able to get an overview, according to Leibniz, one that would not then destroy human personality. But the question is whether he then truly succeeded. This gave occasion then for the theory of monads, in terms of which the interests of mechanism and teleology were supposed to be harmonized. Now, with John Locke, this development, the development that we're following of the development of the idea of human freedom within the context of what is called the science ideal, this was given a new direction by John Locke. And here, there is, Dooyeweerd maintains, a new threat to the ideal of personality. Now, Locke was the first to locate the denominator, to locate this which is to be taken then as the overarching principle, let me say, of interpretation, the denominator for the entire cosmos. He was the first one to find it in the psychical. We have been acquainted with the psyche, the psychical in Leibniz. Let me spell this again, psychical, P-S-Y-C-H-I-C-A-L. Locke is the first one to have taken the psychical as the common denominator. And so in him, there arose the tendency to psychologize experience, a tendency to psychologize experience. I'm just going to stop just a moment, this word psychologize, because I say in one of my writings that our age has been thoroughly psychologized. The influence of this kind of thinking, of this psychical denominator has become very, very widespread. And so some people cannot really think any other way, that their thinking has been completely psychologized. I am willing to say that our age has been completely psychologized. And I point out from time to time, possibly if I've even pointed it out already in this course, that in the comics, the comic Kathy, the comic strip Kathy, is an expression of this complete psychologization. So if you want to have an illustration of what we're talking about here, all you have to do is to go to the Inquirer and read the comic strip Kathy. Well, in any case, now according to Locke, all experience has its origin in simple psychical impressions. Again, there's the same tendency, the method of resolution to enter into, to analyze, by way of a method of resolution, to find then that which is the final, ultimate constituents. And all experience, according to Locke, has its origin in simple psychical impressions. He said there's nothing in the intellect that is not, first of all, given in the senses. And so if we want to know where the things come from in our mind, the ideas that we have, then we analyze and we discover that all of these things then can be then referred to something that we have observed in our sense experience. And he says there's nothing then in the intellect that is not first then given in the senses. According to this method, then, the world of experience is analyzed into discrete elements, and all of these of the nature of sensation. And if these are discrete, these sensations here, these elements of sensation, they don't have any interconnection with one another. The mind relates these to a substance, so something which lies in back of them. We encountered this word, of course, before, both in our discussion of medieval thinking and then most recently in the few words we said about Leibniz. Now we find it again, that if we have reduced things or if we understand things in terms of these individual discrete sensations, we still look for a substance behind them, something which bears them, something which carries them, something which bears them, which then lies behind them. An unknown substance as that which bears them. Now, if this line of thought is carried through, it follows that the ideal which had inspired earlier thinkers, that of a free, creative, mathematical thinking must be abandoned. There was the hope, you see, of a Descartes, the creative, mathematical thinking. The idea, and here was the source of human autonomy and freedom. But it follows then from Locke's position that this ideal which had inspired earlier thinkers must be abandoned. Instead of being the creative source of content, the intellect then is the passive observer of the discrete sensations which come to it from the outer or the inner worlds. What are you going to do? Think of mind as creative? Are you going to associate your freedom, self-determination and everything with your creative mathematical thinking? No. At least the tendency here is to say no, because the intellect then tends to become here the passive observer of the discrete sensations which come to it from outside, yes, as we experience things around us, but also as we experience things within us, as we are the observers of our own passions and our own the impressions that we receive from inside ourselves. It reworks this experience. It can organize this experience, but it does not create this experience. It associates psychical impressions. But this association of psychical impressions is on a secondary plane. First of all, they come to us. They come to us discreetly, and then we rework them, we organize them, but that reworking and organization is on a secondary plane. But now Dooyeweerd points out that Locke did not carry through this program consistently. Later on, we're going to find someone, in fact, the next person with whom we deal, a person who did carry it and did indeed carry it through consistently. But Locke remained with an inconsistent empiricism. The word empiricism is quite well known, of course. E-M-P-I-R-I-C-I-S-M, empiricism, is simply a view which understands our knowledge and things in terms of our experience. It's experience-ordered, oriented. It's an empiricism. He remained then with what has been called an inconsistent empiricism. He did not carry through this psychologization of knowledge. He did not carry through completely. And so mathematical thought for him, with a strict deductive method, remained a major pillar, or the major pillar, of true science. If you're going to have, again, really well-founded knowledge, if you're going to have a means then of this, you again turn toward mathematics. And so there remains, Dooyeweerd maintains, a tension in his thinking. According to the psychological foundation of his thinking, there is no ground for a constancy or an established order in nature. The orderly arrangement to which the mind is irresistibly led does not then stem from the psychical. It must come from beyond the psychical. It cannot stem from the psychical. The orderly coherence of the simple ideas of experience itself cannot be founded in psychical experience. There have to be necessary connections between the ideas, otherwise there would be no basis in science. This cannot be found then by way of referring to psychical impressions. It must come then from a different source, and we'll continue on with that thought as we return. Now we have been looking at the history of humanistic freedom, and that as it has been carried out within the context of what we have been calling, along with Hermann Dooyeweerd, the science ideal, that history and freedom are understood in this context, and so that freedom is discovered along the way of well-founded knowledge, not just opinion, not just certain information of a sort, but knowledge then that is of a well-founded character. Now, as I said, we are following, basically, at least in the first part of this discussion, the second part of Hermann Dooyeweerd's first volume, New Critique of Theoretical Thought. And we have then looked at Descartes, and we have seen something about his position. Descartes, the one who is regarded as the father of modern philosophy. And then we looked at the Thomas Hobbes, and we found that here is the first opposition, as Dooyeweerd describes it, that between Descartes and Hobbes. Descartes, with a using indeed a mechanical model trying to interpret man in this according to this model, but holding back, shying away from the consequences. But then we found in Hobbes that these consequences were carried, the implications of this position were carried out to their extreme. And now we get under what I have here capital B, we have another set of thinkers of in modern philosophy, namely G.W. Leibniz, L-E-I-B-N-I-Z, L-E-I-B-N-I-Z, G.W. Leibniz, and then John Locke. The last name is L-O-C-K-E, John Locke, and then finally David Hume. Now the first one we're going to look at is then G.W. Leibniz, and his dates are 1646 to 1716, 1646 to 1716. Well, we have been tracing then what is a mechanical or mechanistic view of the world. And in within this mechanistic view of the world, we find that the point of view presented in the Middle Ages, the point of view that predominated in the Middle Ages, was supplanted. Now things are not regarded as being informed by an essence, that is, that you can describe the nature of a thing, an essence which then establishes the nature of a thing and the way that thing is realized. If you have an essence, E-S-S-E-N-C-E, that then is supposed to establish the nature of a thing and establish how that thing then comes to realization. Now, in this modern context, the things in the world are regarded as mechanically related to one another by relations of cause and effect. So you're looking at the relationships which are understood in terms of cause and effect, and the way you go at it is to understand then these things functionally in their interrelationships one with the other. Okay. Now with Leibniz, whose philosophy stands at the culmination of the Renaissance, we find one who attempted to reinstate a teleological view of the universe. A teleological view would see that the universe has meaning and purpose to it. And Leibniz then attempted, in the wake of this understanding the world according to a simple mechanical model, he attempted then to reinstate a view that would incorporate meaning and purpose in the universe. Nevertheless, he did this in conjunction with the new mechanical view. It was not then simply going back then to a teleological point of view. It was not simply a regression, but he attempted then to unite this with the new mechanical view of the world. As we saw, Thomas Hobbes had reduced everything to mechanical movement. He considered everything in terms of what we can call the denominator. He took as his denominator mechanical movement and interpreted everything in terms of it. But as we pointed out, this mechanical view was always regarded as a threat to meaning and to personality. As we were looking at these earlier figures, we found that according to these views, man became a spectator of those forces that were determining his existence. And what that meant was that man was no longer self-determining. He was reduced to a spectator of the forces determining his existence. And that meant a crisis of the humanistic view of freedom, which has as one of its major constituents the idea of self-determination. Now, Leibniz is loyal to this new mechanical view. In fact, he helped to instate it. Nevertheless, as we say, he tried to connect it again with a view of teleology so that we could find meaning and purpose in it, and in so doing, then, that man again could find himself and that his personality would not then be threatened. Now, in order to effect this rehabilitation, Leibniz attempted to reconcile mechanical motion with purpose. He tried to see whether the mechanical processes of nature could not be traced back to causes whose operation would give to mechanical movement a meaning, a kind of cause, a causal investigation indeed, but one then that would give mechanical movement a meaning and an end, or a telos. And so, accordingly, he did not want to speak only of atoms. He did not want to speak simply of bodies in motions, or atoms, let's say, in motions. Did not want to speak simply of corpuscles working according to mechanical laws, laws of attraction and repulsion, let us say. Instead, he developed a different idea. What are the building blocks of the universe into which it can be analyzed? And we saw that was a characteristic of this modern thinking, to try by a way of resolution, as it was called, to find those ultimate building blocks or the final building blocks of the universe, to break it down and to build it up again. We saw this in Descartes. But now, Leibniz says, if we then analyze, we find the fundamental building blocks, but these then are purposeful beings. They are of a nature not just inert matter, but they are psychical. They are psychical entities, psychical beings. And he calls them then entelechies, E-N-T-E-L-E-C-H-I-E-S, entelechies. These as purposeful psychical beings. Now these entelechies, or we can also say in his terms monads, M-O-N-A-D-S, these entelechies or monads were regarded by him as being independent centers of activity and force. They're independent centers of activity and force. We might very well expect that, of course, at least as far as force is concerned, because we are dealing in an era in which the movement, the kinetic, is very, very important. He thought of these then as centers of activity and force, but of a psychical character. The substances are not merely inert. They don't have as simply their main characteristics that they are unchangeable, but they're actively operating centers of force. So the image that we have to have in our mind here is then not of inert atoms, not of inert things to which you have then come down in your analysis, but these vital sources of energy and movement of a psychical character. They're actively operating centers of force. And so substance, for Leibniz, takes on the meaning of force. There's energy, there's force here in as we look at the meaning of substance. And the conception of God, the way he considered God too, took on the meaning of creative force. God is creative force. And so the fundamental thought here is that this creative force manifests itself, it shows itself in the mechanical system of motions in the world. If you look at the mechanical system, you don't simply rest there, but you see then that this then is a manifestation of the creative force within the cosmos, and that then has its center in God. So the conception of God took on the meaning of creative force, and the fundamental thought was that this creative force manifests itself in the mechanical system of motions in the world. Now, according to Leibniz, then, the universe is made up of an infinite number of independent centers of force, an infinite number of these things, an infinite number of monads, again, M-O-N-A-D-S, monads. But he said these things, these individual monads, are not dependent upon one another in an external sense, in a causal sense, in the sense of an external causality. Nevertheless, they stand in relation to one another. So we find that he tries to have it from both sides. Each monad, in relation to the rest of the monads, is a perfectly independent being. And Leibniz put this in, as you are likely aware, in a very pictorial way. He ascribed this independency, he talked about this independency in these terms, that the monads had no windows. There's no way to look in or no way for them to look out. Each monad is, in relation to the rest, a perfectly independent being. It has no windows, nothing that can blow in and nothing that can blow out. And so the monad is a perfectly internal principle. It's all wrapped up in itself. It's a center of force as an perfectly internal principle. And substance, then, is a force of immanent activity. If you have the idea of substance before, then with the idea that it is inert, here you have substance identified with force, and substance is a force of immanent activity. Each monad, then, is an independent psyche. We talked about that they're psychical in nature. Each monad would be an independent psyche, P-S-Y-C-H-E, an independent psyche. And there is a great difference, therefore, an infinite number of these monads, each one then closed in on itself, but nevertheless related to all the other monads. And so in this, Leibniz attempted to have differentiation. No monad is just like any other monad. But nevertheless, there is unity, he said, there is unity in differentiation. Now, Hobbes then discovered a basic denominator. A denominator will be then something that we take a general term, a general designation, that then can apply to everything. He took then as his basic denominator, that in terms of which he could understand everything, he found it in this in these entelechies, and he thought he had discovered thereby something that would relieve him of reducing everything's, as Thomas Hobbes did, to mechanical motion. If you're going to reduce everything to mechanical motion, and we might say if you're going to reduce anything to that which it amounts to a portion of the cosmos, a side of the cosmos, instead of reflecting on the cosmos as a whole, what you're going to do is put man in an observer situation so that he is looking at that which then bears in upon him and determines his existence. Has now Leibniz avoided that by avoiding, as he thought, reducing everything to mechanical motion. Now, in line with his discovery of the infinitesimal calculus, he thought he had discovered a way of bridging the most diverse aspects of the cosmos. All kinds of diversity and nevertheless unity. He needed a bridge, and he thought he had discovered a way of bridging the most diverse aspects of the cosmos. These infinite monads fill space without a gap. There's no gap between them. There's no jump or space then between them. The infinite number of monads fill space without a gap in an infinite gradation. No monad is just like any other monad, but there's an infinite gradation between them. But nevertheless, they reflect each other. And they reflect each other in this fashion because each monad, in its own fashion, reflects the entire range of the cosmos. If you'd have then the monad is going to be an independent a substance. It is then distinct from all the rest, and yet it is ranged in the order, an infinite order of an infinite number of monads. Each one is independent to itself. It is then self-enclosed. It has no windows, but each one of them relates to all the others. Each one of them, in its own fashion, from its own point of view, reflects the entire range of the cosmos. So, in his view of substance, he thought, there's unity in diversity. Each one, then, of these is the world force, but in a particular way. Each substance, in its own way, represents the manifold, or the complex pattern of the world. But the monads cannot be distinguished according to the content they represent, because, as we said, the entire content of the world is represented in each one. So what you're not going to be able to do is to say, here's a monad that represents this kind of content in the world, and there's a monad that reflects another kind of content in the world. You can't do that because the fact that each monad reflects from its own point of view the content of the world. The entire content of the world is represented in each one. The way one distinguishes the monad, according to Leibniz, is the fashion or the way in which these represent the content of the world. And his criterion here is very much like that of Descartes. The difference is found according to the differing degrees of clarity and distinctness with which each monad represents the universe. So each one is going to represent the entire universe. You cannot distinguish them according to the content that they have, but you can indeed distinguish them according to the clarity and the distinctness with which they reflect, with which they represent the universe. And so the criterion of clarity and distinctness, which we found in René Descartes, becomes in Leibniz the criterion for the distinction between the monads. And there's another thing too. It's not then only that is clarity and distinctness, as if that again were simply, an intellectual thing. But it is this: a monad is active insofar as it represents the universe clearly and distinctly, and it is inactive or passive insofar as it represents the universe in an obscure and confused way. Michael?
Does this seem to you to be an incipient pantheism, or has he ever been laid open to the charge of, or a hylozoism or something like that?
The question is then whether this, as I've been criticized, whether this is an incipient pantheism, and whether it might then be dubbed or has been criticized as a hylozoism. A hylozoism would be that in some way matter is per se informed with life. And if you take this psychical point of view, and if you consider then in some way a psyche is living, and if then you say in your interpretation of matter that you have to interpret it then in terms of psyche, and then that involves some kind of life, the term hylozoism, well, I don't know whether one really ought to throw the term at it, but nevertheless, there would be some parallels. Now, I do not actually know whether people have simply accused him of any hylozoism. And as I've looked at hylozoism, I think of something somewhat different. But nevertheless, it certainly would border on it if it is not actually that. As far as a pantheism is concerned, I'm going to be saying this later on, that it seems to me that in modern philosophy, when you have the idea of the divine entering into and informing the world, as you have it here, when you have man then in his personality participating in the divine, if that isn't pantheism, it's very close to it. Then that confusion there, where there is not a proper recognition of the relationship of creator-creature and the boundary between them, I would say borders on pantheism. So, I mean, those two questions, I'm not ready in either case simply to call Leibniz pantheistic nor hylozoistic, but I am prepared to say, as even I had, that it would certainly border on these things. Now, we can see then how Leibniz joins this conception here with teleology, with the idea of meaning and purpose and end. Because each of the monads is attempting to ascend the scale, to pass from obscure representation of the universe to a clear representation of the universe. So you have an order in here, in an order of increasing clarity, and each monad then is struggling to realize itself. Each monad is struggling then to pass from obscure representation of the universe to clear representation of the universe. And so the goal of the life of a monad is to clear up its content, to come to greater clarity, to come to greater perception here. Yes?
By psychical, does he mean conscious? Self-reflecting, in a sense?
Well, the question then is whether in the idea of the psychical, whether Leibniz refers to conscious and self-reflecting. You did say that. As I see it, in the idea of freedom, as it occurs in the humanistic context, the idea of self-reflection, that one reflects on himself, and so that in his act he is identical with himself. He is self-determining, he is identical with himself. That idea recurs here, because each of these monads is a completely self-contained, and in that way, it is reflecting on itself, and it is autonomous in this fashion. And so the relationships between the monads has to be understood in such a way as not to disturb, as not then to take away this independency and it's really a self-determination here. Now, So again, it seems to me that there is an idea of self-determination that is involved here. Now, a consciousness and awareness, is there a full awareness in all of the monads? That's difficult to say. No, well, of course, there is not, even though this is true, because it is only then as there's an additional clarity and distinctness that I think that one could speak then in these strictly personal terms. But again, the question, I think, is apt, and we discover in the way Leibniz is approaching things is that he is struggling with what we have come to think of as the ideal of personality, and that personality, in this broader sense of the word, might then be saved, might then be have a real place here. Yes, Mike?
Well, does he use his idea of monads then as something that man should emulate, or does he call man a monad, and does he use this idea as a basis for ethics?
Well, man, in this scale here, man would be a monad too. God is a monad. As we shall see in a few minutes, then God is the highest monad. And that man would be a monad also. But obviously, not every monad then is human, not every monad is God. But it's all really, in a, such a scheme, you see how the boundaries are not kept. Because of the fact that man and every other monad would really have to be struggling to become God.